This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. And I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 4 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us about today's topic.
We have something a little different today, Steve. We're going to be taking a look at what Canadian observatories have been up to lately, and also trace back some of the history and achievements over the past century. And to help us out, we'll be talking with Laurie Roche and Ben Dorman, two people with a very close connection to the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory in Victoria.
Now, for listeners familiar with that particular observatory, you might know it by another name. Now, with tongue firmly in cheek, I apologize in advance to those from Toronto who will be shocked to learn that Victoria's observatory is also known as the center of the universe.
Ouch. I don't know if this will be any comfort to Torontonians, but let's not use all the cheap shots right at once, Steve. We have to pace ourselves after all. But interestingly enough, and speaking of the center of the universe, since it's expanding equally in all directions, well, wherever you might happen to be standing, that too is the center of the universe. We'll talk about that in more detail some other time. But before we start in on our primary topic today about Canadian observatories, I've got a short update to share, and that's about the successful launch of the Polaris Dawn mission. That was the privately funded flight aboard a SpaceX rocket that took four civilians into space in September of this year.
And before we go too much further into this update, Tim, I think we should focus a bit upon the word civilian when used in aerospace terms. Few people realize that famed astronaut Neil Armstrong was deemed to be a civilian when he went to the moon. To the uninitiated, that sort of sounds like NASA picked some guy up off the street, gave him some cursory training, and shazam, he's walking on the moon. In reality, Armstrong had been a U.S. Navy test pilot and fighter pilot flying combat missions during the Korean War. And then he retired from the military to pursue flying the X-15 rocket ship before his Gemini and Apollo missions.
And in a similar vein, Steve, the so-called civilian astronauts on board Polaris Dawn were neither retailers nor store clerks. So Commander Jared Isaacman is a qualified military jet pilot who performs at air shows. And Scott Poteet is a retired U.S. Air Force lieutenant colonel, and he served 18 years in a variety of flying roles, including being a member of the famed Thunderbirds aerobatic team.
And I understand that Sarah Levengelis has a degree in aerospace engineering. And finally, Anna Wilhelm has both a bachelor and master's of science degrees in biomedical engineering and has served as the biomedical flight controller for the ISS. And all to say, I guess that goes to show that when the media uses the term civilian astronaut, we the public should be a bit more appreciative of their skills and talents.
They've got lots. But what was, I think, really interesting about this Polaris Dawn mission was that it was undertaking to study the impact of human health when traveling beyond low Earth orbit, something humans haven't actually done since the Apollo program. So since the time of the moon missions, astronauts, Soviet cosmonauts, and Chinese taikonauts, they've all remained in low Earth orbit, which provides a significant measure of protection from solar radiation, bearing in mind that the typical altitude of the ISS, it's around 400 kilometers. However, the Polaris Dawn's altitude of 1,400 kilometers above the Earth's surface took them into the Van Allen radiation belt, which is chock-a-block full with harmful solar radiation.
Now, to mitigate those risks, spacecraft designers employed various shielding techniques and carefully planned mission trajectories to minimize time spent in the most intense regions of the Van Allen belt. Additionally, The astronauts' exposure was closely monitored with sensors, which measured their cumulative radiation exposure to ensure that it remained within safe limits. You know, Tim, this kind of reminds me of when my dad was flying CF-100s with 445 Squadron in France in the 1960s. All pilots wore black radiation dosimeter discs around their necks, which were opened and examined on a regular basis. Now, this may sound high tech, but it wasn't. Inside the disc was a piece of ordinary camera film, which would become fogged if exposed to radiation, with no regard to when it got exposed, by what type of radiation it was exposed, nor by how much radiation.
Astronauts already wear sensors that add up their total radiation exposure over time, but the information on them can only be read when they come back to Earth in a special lab. To give a more accurate picture, scientists and engineers from the European Space Agency, they are developing active dosimeters to map both deep space and lunar radiation environments in as complete a manner as possible. Now, there are a couple of key takeaways from the Polaris Dawn mission, Steve. First off, this science experiment studying the impact of radiation on astronauts involves private sector technology, civilian astronauts, and private funding. And the second takeaway would be that the lessons learned are all pointing towards the future of human flight beyond the Earth. So, Steve, how about an update? What do you have for us today?
Well, almost as a bit of whimsy, I came across the following nugget about how dark it's really out there in space.
Really? Well, we've just seen the Polaris Dawn astronauts conduct tethered spacewalks, and the space behind their white suits is just that, dark. So isn't dark its own, what, definition? I mean, dark is dark. What more can there be?
Well, I would have thought the same thing as well, Tim. And today's story goes all the way back to 2006, when NASA launched the New Horizons space probe to explore Pluto and beyond. By now, New Horizons has traveled far past Pluto and is 8.7 billion kilometers from Earth. And as you can imagine, that's far from the light pollution of Earth, and indeed our sun would appear as the merest of specks. To get an idea of how dark it is in deep space, NASA scientists had New Horizons rotate about its axis so that its camera was in its own shadow and pointed away from both the sun and the disk of the Milky Way.
So that's like turning your back to the sun on a cloudy day and then taking a photo the other way. Is that right?
Exactly so. And then New Horizons took 24 separate images of dark areas of space. Now, the science team then calculated how much of whatever light there was in those images, which was due to ambient light from stars and dust within our Milky Way, and subtracted that to find the total amount of background light in the universe. The result was an astonishingly dim glow of roughly 11 nanowatts per square meter per steradian. And I know nobody understands what that means.
Well, I don't know. Well, I do know that a nanowatt is a billionth of a watt. So we're talking about 11 billionths of a watt. And I'm pretty sure we all know how bright a 60-watt light bulb is. But who knows? I don't. What is a steradian? So, as we try to do on Space Talks, we like to give a nice, easy-to-understand analogy. And Steve, you've always got best. So, what have you got for us?
Well, imagine you're in a deserted cabin on a moonless night in the middle of nowhere. Your nearest neighbor is 2 kilometers away and he opens his refrigerator door. The change of light on the wall of your cabin when he opens the fridge is the intensity of the space light that they measured. Now, let's put it another way. This is 100 times darker than even the darkest sky ever on Earth. And if you think that feeble amount of light is the total sum of all the light from all the galaxies and all the stars in the entire universe. So, 11 billionth of a watt? Wow, space is dark. Now, Tim, I know you're going to be talking about Canadian observatories, and I know of only a couple, and they're not the one that you're going to focus upon today.
You're right, and there's a lot to dig into. In fact, we're only going to start in on this topic today. There's just too much for us to cover off in one episode. We are going to be taking an extra close look at the Victoria-based observatory But I think we need a bit of context first as to the history of this one observatory and how it should be seen in Canada's national investment in space research, and should also be seen as a classic example of Canada's collaborative efforts with other countries.
I suspect, Tim, that today many people would be surprised to learn just how long Canada has been in the field of astronomy, building and operating observatories right across the country, dating back to one in Ottawa, which was in operation back in 1905. Now that one, on Carling Avenue, is known as the Dominion Observatory, and it remained active until 1970. It's also one of the observatories that you and I have come to know as longtime Ottawa residents. Now, we previously mentioned the observatory that had been in operation on the shores of Lake Travers in Algonquin Park. And another one with a distinguished history would be the David Dunlop Observatory in Downsview, Ontario. It opened in 1935 with the second largest reflector telescope in the world. That observatory operated until 2007, but remains an important facility for public engagement.
I actually visited the Dominion Observatory just once in the late 1960s. I was a young lad at the time and lived in Toronto. A friend and I, we rode our bicycles to Ottawa, and when we arrived, we stayed with my brother, and he had had a summer job at the observatory, which he held on to for a couple of summers. So how about you, Steve?
Well, having passed that many times on Carling Avenue, I took advantage of an open house one evening and took in a group lecture and a chance to look through the telescope at a binary star system. But the viewing was far less than perfect because of the city's light pollution, something alluded to earlier in today's update.
Now, let's not leave the impression that the best is behind us. Canada has a considerable track record understanding neutrinos. That's the so-called ghost particle. Steve, what did you find out about SNOLAB?
SNOLAB is another of those wonderful acronyms and is an underground lab that grew out of the original Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, or SNO, and of course that becomes SNOW. It's located deep underground in a large cavern where the experiments are conducted, with additional space for all the supporting infrastructure and people who work there. To get to the lab, you enter the Crichton Mine, which used to be owned by Inco, but is now owned by Vale. You descend 2,000 meters into the deepest nickel mine in Canada through what's called the Number 9 Shaft, and then continue 1.4 kilometers from the shaft to reach Snow Lab itself. Since the lab is so deep underground, the surrounding rock temperature is about 42 degrees Celsius, and that's pretty hot. And there's about 2 kilometers of granite above you, which acts as a natural shield from cosmic radiation.
So the concept here is that the overhead granite is a shielding agent acting as a giant clean room, similar to those in high-tech labs or a microchip factory. And to keep the lab itself clean and free from dust or contaminants, everyone entering has to go through a full cleaning process, whereby you get out of your clothing, shower, and then put on a sterile clean room clothing to prevent dust from entering the space. Equipment and materials go through some kind of cleaning process as well, either in an underground car wash, if you will, or at the surface before being sealed and brought down.
And with regard to size, the lab has about 5,000 square meters of clean space, with 3,100 square meters dedicated to the main experimental caverns where the research itself happens. There's also about 2,600 square meters outside the clean room that's used for things like moving materials, storing equipment, and maintaining the lab. The clean areas have a special feature such as painted concrete floors and radon blocking paint on the walls, while the spaces outside are more basic, with some areas having gravel floors and the others with concrete pads for the easier handling of materials coming into that lab.
Let's just say that the purpose of SNOLAB is to detect neutrinos, which are very small subatomic particles. And to answer the inevitable question, how small are they? Well, let's just say that 100 trillion of them pass through your body every second. And not only don't you feel them, they don't interact with you. It's far beyond the scope of space talks to go into neutrinos. I know I certainly couldn't. And the intricacies of SNOLAB, but Interested listeners are advised to begin their own personal research. Go to YouTube and check out a brief video entitled A Visit to Snow Lab and Snow Lab Inside the Dark Matter, Lab Buried Over a Mile Underground. You won't be disappointed. There is a fabulous observatory just a few minutes from my home on Vancouver Island. First off, it's been contributing insights into our universe for over 100 years. Now, we just mentioned the Dominion Observatory in Ottawa. Its focus had been on astrometry, star positioning, and cataloging. Around the corner from me, however, is the Dominion Astronomical Observatory, a similar name, but here the focus has been on astrophysics, and that meaning the physics and science of stars. Rather than make a lot of notes while discussing the observatory with some local experts, Steve, I thought we'd let them talk to us directly and to our listeners. Lori Roche and Ben Dorman are not employed by the observatory, but they have been champions advocating for its funding and leading the way in connecting the observatory to students, visitors, and astronomy buffs. Let's have a listen. So, Lori and Ben, you're both active with the Friends of the Observatory. Perhaps you can start us out today by explaining what this organization is and how it's linked with the observatory itself. What prompted you to both become volunteers, for example?
A professional astronomer is my first career. I worked in University of Virginia and NASA Goddard Space Flight Center for a number of years after graduating with a PhD in astronomy from the University of Victoria. I subsequently got married and had children, one of whom has a disability, and that got me into nonprofit work and nonprofit advocacy. So when there came a need to form an organization to advocate for astronomy, I figured I had both skill sets.
That's not the case. I can well understand that. And Laurie, how about yourself? You were a teacher, I understand.
Yes, I taught for 34 years. And then, and during some of that time when I moved to Victoria, I knew that the Dominion Observatory had Saturday night public star parties up on the hill. And I went with the Royal Astronomical Society and started to do some volunteering up there during the time when, in fact, the center of the universe was part of the NRC. When that program was kind of canceled, they asked for a charitable organization to take over the public face of the DAO. And so Ben and I were kind of in on the ground floor of starting off the Friends of the DAO so that we would become the charitable arm and be able to do all the front-facing public programming for the NRC. And that's what we still continue to do today. We started off quite small, and now 9 years later, we're right in the middle of trying to get even more funding and more work in the schools. We're trying to find more schools that we can go to. It's just trying to expand from where we started as a very small organization 9 years ago.
I think that's wonderful that there's this community-led advocacy organization. But I wanted to tie that in to the history of the observatory, because I think John Plaskett, who was a founder and an advocate for this, had always imagined the observatory's mission was in part to engage with the community. And so here we are some more than 100 years later, and that's still the case, but let's not get ahead of the horse or whatever here. Perhaps Ben, you could help me out here. Tell me a little bit about how Plaskett played this role way back in the beginning of the early years of the 20th century to push for and then achieve this observatory.
Well, Plaskett was raised on a farm in Ontario and came to astronomy later in life after an engineering background. He became an assistant at what was then called the Dominion Observatory in Ottawa. And they had built a telescope purely for the purpose of what's called astrometry, which is getting the precise positions of stars for navigation purpose. At the same time, there was a new science of astrophysics generated, which started up in the late 1890s, which really started to understand what the stars and the things in the sky were made of. And Plaskett's vision was to build the biggest instrument in the world to join in the science of astrophysics in Canada. If you imagine that the telescope was built between 1914 and 1918, which are significant dates for other reasons, this project was nevertheless completed in the middle of a major war. And so he must have been an amazingly effective advocate himself to make sure that this great enterprise actually took place.
And it was the largest telescope for a brief amount of time. It was a world beater for a short while.
It was the largest operational telescope for much of 1918. At the same time as the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory was coming online, there was in California the effort to build the 100-inch telescope on Mount Wilson, which is famous for being used by Edwin Hubble. Hubble was the man who first realized that the universe was expanding through observations.
And I know that the lens that was used in the 1918 version of the observatory wasn't easily taken up the hill to the observatory. And Laurie, if I'm not mistaken, didn't this involve horses?
Yes. In fact, I'm going to just correct you one little bit. It's actually not a lens. It was a mirror. This was a reflecting telescope, not a refracting telescope. So the mirror was actually started in Belgium. And it came over to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to be worked on. It was 1.8 meters or about 72 inches in size. And as we said, at one time, that was the largest working telescope mirror in the world. They actually built the telescope between 1914 and 1916. The actual telescope was all ready to go. The dome was finished. Everything was done. And the mirror had to be redone. The mirror didn't get put into the telescope until 1918. All the pieces that had to be put together were really incredibly heavy. The whole thing is about 43 tons. And so each part had to be brought up individually on wagons that were pulled by sets of horses, anywhere from about a team of 8 to a team of 12. And it actually took 2 days to get some of these pieces up the hill because one set of horses could only take it partway up the hill in a day. And they had to take those horses back down again, put another set of horses back up to take it all the way back up the hill. So it took quite a long time for it to be put together. But Plaskett was amazing in that he really did an excellent job of getting everything ready and working and ready to go. So that May the 6th, 1918, which was what we call first light on a telescope, was the first time that that scientific data had been taken by the telescope at that point.
Mm-hmm. It is an amazing story to imagine that this endeavor to understand the universe was something that required the help of a few horses. It's a remarkable part of the story. I'm also taken by the fact that I live quite close to Burchard Gardens, which is famous for attracting people. But it's my understanding that the observatory was also an incredibly popular tourist destination.
We had 20,000 people in a few years back in the late teens, and like 1916 to 1920. And then at the early part of the 1920s, like 20,000 people would come up in a year to come up and see the telescope. They came up on the ENN railway for something like a 50-cent trip from Victoria up to the, and then they walked, or I guess took horses or carriages or something up the hill to the top. It was a very, very popular venue. And it also was really important for the economic aspect of Victoria to have all these people come in to have a look at the telescope. It was amazing, actually, at that time.
And it was also the case that the people who worked at the observatory, they used to regularly write for the Daily Colonist, which was the paper at the time. And the astronomers used to do public talks that were quite popular, advertised in the daily papers. So they reached, I believe, just under 40,000 people visiting the observatory in the late 30s. And by comparison, we, with our much larger population, we have reached 10,000 visitors a year, but we're still not close to the peak of interest that occurred earlier in.
Steve and I on our show routinely make mention of achievements by Canadians wherever possible, and it would be wrong for us to be talking about these early years. This was not a fanciful mission that Plaskett had in mind. It was one that did quite a lot of important science, and I don't want to go into granular level detail about the kind of science that was done 100 years ago, but I do want to make mention, or have you folks make mention, I've read that he was particularly interested in spectroscopy, binary stars, and I think maybe the easiest one to talk about is understanding the Milky Way.
Yes. So all of that, the spectroscopy used for binary stars, the binary star research used for determining where stars were physically in space, and all of that culminating in understanding that we live in a spiral galaxy which is rotating once every 225 or so million years. So that is a fact that we take for granted now, but that was a major discovery of the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory in the late 20s. While Mr. Hubble was working on the expansion of the universe in California, the astronomers in Victoria were discovering the dynamics of our own galaxy.
Thanks, Ben, and thank you, Laurie, for what was a really interesting interview. Thank you very much.
That was a pretty amazing interview which you conducted, Tim, and no doubt it's the first time these founding directors have aired both their personal achievements and those of the Dominion Astronomical Observatory in Victoria.
I'm still trying to get my head around the fact that John Plaskett, the founding director of the observatory, he was born before Confederation, but he had this ambition to push Canada to the forefront of astronomy and astrophysics.
And though I knew that Edwin Hubble's astronomical work in California led to the understanding of an expanding universe, which up to that time was thought to be stationary and fixed, I had no idea that the Dominion Astronomical Observatory in Victoria was the first in the world to determine that our sun was actually in a spiral galaxy, which we now call the Milky Way. So, hooray for Canada and hooray for British Columbia. Now, Tim, I noticed at the beginning of that interview with Laurie and Ben, you mentioned the current work agenda at the observatory. Are we going to be hearing more about that on Space Talks?
You bet. And in addition to learning about the technological upgrades and new science priorities, I also talked with Laurie about their outreach programs and public engagement. And from the standpoint of British Columbians, there are some, you know, just great opportunities to be connected with the observatory. Now, obviously, one aspect is their online programming, and that's all available at their website. Here it comes, centeroftheuniverse.org. But Laurie was also detailing some other programs we're going to hear about that are available to on site at the observatory, star parties, lectures, even concerts and the occasional movie. But also, Steve, they have a program connecting astronomers with teachers and students across the province. And we hope that we've piqued listener interest to explore more about Polaris Dawn and radiation shielding for astronauts, as well as perhaps delving into the mysteries of the elusive neutrino. So please stay tuned to Space Talks for much more to come. This is Tim Woods, just down the road from the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory on Vancouver Island.
And Stephen Lowry and Salmon Arms saying so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?